Okay, welcome everybody. This is our 37th class, and big yasher koach for everybody who's actually been with us nearly every single week. Keep on going. This is our third time doing Parshas Pinchas, so we cover other topics in the Parsha. Just go to yutera.org and check out Rabbi Kenny Rosenthal and Parshas Pinchas. You'll see the other classes. Okay. The title of the class is Man of War, Man of Peace, Pinchas and Menachem Begin. On the sheet here, which I'm going to share with you in a moment, it has basically the initial Wikipedia entry, your basic information. Menachem Begin was an Israeli politician, founder of Likud and the sixth prime minister of Israel. Before the creation of the State of Israel, he was a leader of the Zionist militant group Irgun, in other words, which was a revisionist breakaway from the larger paramilitary organization Haganah, and basically proclaimed a revolt in 1944 against the British mandatory government, which was opposed by the Jewish agency. So basically, he fought against the British to kick them out, and then he fought the Arabs in 1947 in the civil war against the Arabs in pre-state Israel. And then he joined the opposition as Herut. So we're going to show two videos. The background for this video is, it's funny how things have not changed, but he becomes prime minister in 1977, which was a landslide because it unseated the Labor Party, which had hold on since the beginning of the State of Israel. And in the United Nations, the German Council suggested that Begin and the Israeli government set up a Palestinian state. Okay? So this is a short clip. It's in Hebrew, and if you've got video, it's has subtitles, but I will summarize it at the end. Okay? So let's go to the video tape. Here we go. All right, we will share screen action. Here we go. All right, so let me just summarize. So people were upset at him that he basically blew off the...
President Carter.
Hold on.
Mrs. Carter.
Okay, hold on. I'm not going to... All right, so anyways, So who can summarize what was his basic response back to why he was so negative toward the Chancellor Schmidt's suggestion of creating a Palestinian state? And why is he critical of the people who are critical of him for being so dismissive? That was, you know, what was his essential point to the people who were criticizing him?
It seems like if there's a Palestinian state, he was concerned about the safety of the Jews, of the Jewish people living in Israel. That he thought there was a Palestinian state, that they would annihilate the Jewish people. And then he's questioning taking the advice from the German chancellor after Germany killed, or Nazi Germany under Hitler, killed so many Jewish people.
Right. You know, he felt like it's a huge question. Like, you're telling me how to secure my, I'm responsible for the well-being of the Jewish people who live in Israel, which at that time was 3.5 million. Now we're at 6.5 million. And you want me to have a situation that we're going to have. It's funny how he focused. He said, well, how are they going to do it? By having Katyusha, in other words, rockets. He already foreshadowed by having a close by Palestinian state, it's going to cause rockets to come shooting into the Israel proper, which of course, you know, when the Jews withdrew in 2005 from Gaza, literally happened. So, you know, he said it's a big chutzpah. And everybody who's all people who are civil and are going to get all their nose twisted, he said, fine, let them have twisted noses. So he's a fight. He says, I grew up, I was in the Irgun. I was in the underground. I saw death every day. I'm not afraid of anyone. And does anybody remember what happened to, you know, does everybody not forget what happened to my people? What happened to my family? He lost many of it. A lot of his family were killed in the Holocaust. He escaped actually to Russia, which he was then put into a Siberian camp for a time until he got his way to the land of Israel. So he's a guy who's clearly a fighter, you know, not going to, you know, and he doesn't care standing up to anybody for anything. Here's the second video, and this is the Camp David, after the Camp David agreement cementing the peace between Egypt and Israel. Does anybody know what that was? This is going back to the 70s, 1979. What was the guy? Come on, this is like... Israeli History 101. What was the Camp David Accord, the peace agreement between Israel and Egypt? What was the fundamental agreement? You guys remember that?
That they would return the Sinai Peninsula after the 73 war.
Well, it didn't happen. It happened in 79. In other words, they agreed to give back the entire Sinai Peninsula, correct? In exchange for peace with Israel, and also they're going to evacuate the various settlements that were in the Sinai desert. Here's a clip of him talking about the situation here. Let's get a little video. Let's go to the videotape. This is in English, so everybody can follow easier.
Mr. President of the United States, Mr. President of the Arab Republic, ladies and gentlemen, the Camp David Conference should be renamed. It was the Jimmy Carter Conference. President took an initiative. Most imaginative downtime, and brought President Sadat and myself and our colleagues and friends and advisors together under one roof. In itself, it was a great achievement, but the President took a great risk himself. and did it with great civil courage. And it was a famous French field commander who said that it is much more difficult to show civil courage than military courage. And the president went. As far as my historic experience is concerned, I think that he worked harder than our forefathers did in Egypt building the pyramids. Yes, indeed. Work day and night. And so did we. Day and night. We used to go to bed, Camp David, between 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning. Rise as we are used to since our boyhood, at 5 and 6. That's a big way. The president showed interest in every section, every paragraph, every sentence, every word, every letter of the framework. We had some difficult moments, as usually. There are some crises in negotiations. As usually, somebody gives a hint that perhaps you'd like to pick up and go home. It's all usual. But ultimately, ladies and gentlemen, the president of the United States won the day. Peace now celebrates a great victory. The nations of Egypt, Israel, and all mankind.
All right. Here's my question for you all. Were you able to hear that well? No? You weren't able to hear that?
It was a little tough to hear.
Yeah, not so much.
Oh, boy. All right, so basically, also, just to summarize, I don't know, is it the volume problem or the way he articulates his English?
It's a screen sharing, a video through Zoom issue, I think. I don't think it's really a volume issue. That's my personal opinion. I don't know if anybody else.
You can't, so it's hard to do that. It doesn't come. Are all videos like this, or just certain volumes, which is just?
Generally speaking, I would say most of the videos have that problem.
Oh, so even if I put on loud, what if I put speakers on? Would that make it better? Or we, whatever. All right, we have to figure out a way. Okay, so let's. Anyways. Whatever. So, to summarize the 3 minutes, he basically talked about how Menachem Begin worked with President Jimmy Carter and Anwar Sadat, you know, day and night with crises, and you know, hammered out a piece. Which, by the way, to this very day, the government of Egypt there's a cold peace with Israel, and they help out Israel as far as dealing with Gaza, and you know there's a decent relationship there. They're not lovers of us, you know. There's plenty of anti-Semitism in their press, but there hasn't been any problems since 1977. Do you guys remember what happened to Anwar Sadat? Do you remember this?
He was assassinated.
He was assassinated, principally because of this, from Islamic extremists. The foreshadowing, I think, of Al-Qaeda, you know, and that kind of mentality. So I don't know if you can look into that more. So here's my question. What are the challenges in one and the same person being both a militant and a peacemaker? Was Menachem Begin a militant when he was young and a peacemaker when he was old? What do you guys say? Are those qualities easy to be in the same person?
I think he needed to be what the situation called for. That you can be both of those, both a militant and a peacemaker. But again, the founding of the State of Israel, when he was in the Irgun, he fought when he needed to fight because peace wouldn't have happened otherwise. Whereas later on with Sadat and Carter, there was no need if they were meeting and having these discussions and peaceful negotiations.
Correct. Now, was he militant after 1977? This is a history. This is a advanced Israel history question. Does anybody know? He ordered the first Lebanon War in 1982. So he was also, even after the peace treaty, he was also a person to order a war. Lebanon number one. To the idea of going into Lebanon to clear out, Arafat's Fatah, you know, terrorists who were bombing the northern communities with all kinds of rockets and bombs, etc.
Wasn't that the whole fiasco with the Bekaa Valley?
There were many problems. There was the massacre of Shatila.
Right.
There was all kinds of, it was first of all, it's a brutal war. A lot of guys have died. Now, on the MG Israel trip, we have visited in the past Yeshivat Har Etzion. Okay. We've actually visited. Suzanne, were you on when we went to visit it? Now.
Yes.
Yeah. So when you go, they have one of the largest, more beautiful Jewish libraries. In the library, every single bookcase has a picture of an 18, 19-year-old boy. A lot of those guys were called up in the 73 war, died, and also a lot of guys were called up in Lebanon and died. So many of bookcases you're going to see guys who died in battle, either 73, which was brutal, and also in Lebanon 1 and 82. It was a brutal, anytime a close proximity warfare, it was not easy. But going back to what Shayna pointed out, she's arguing that, so are you saying that is he militant and a peacemaker? Is it he's both? He's none? What is he?
I was saying he was both. He was what he needed to be, depending on the situation.
Okay, so that's a nice introduction to take a look at Koheles, Ecclesiastes. All right, let me have somebody. It's actually a famous song. Let me have Mendel read.
Koheles, chapter 3. 1. A season is set for everything, a time for every experience under heaven. A time for being born and a time for dying. A time for planting and a time for uprooting the planted. A time for slaying and a time for healing. A time for tearing down and a time for building up. A time for weeping and a time for laughing. A time for wailing and a time for dancing. A time for throwing stones and a time for gathering stones. A time for embracing and a time for shunning embraces. A time for seeking and a time for losing. A time for keeping and a time for discarding. A time for ripping and a time for sowing, a time for silence and a time for speaking, a time for loving and a time for hating, a time for war and a time for peace.
Okay. This, of course, section was turned into a song for every season, turn. Right. All right. So what challenge of temperament does Koheles guide us to cultivate in ourselves?
Well, in a sense, there seems to be a very much, seeing both sides of something. On one hand, on another hand, it seems like he's trying to help us understand the idea that, there are times for different attitudes and different approaches to things. That there's a different time for different to understand. You can understand things in a different way. Sometimes very opposite ways.
But they're all opposite, right? So this is not so simple.
Yeah.
Because some people are naturally, like, how about a time for silence and time for speaking? Usually you have people who are either quiet people, and they're people who are talkative, over-talkative people. To know how to, when to be quiet and when to be silent, that takes tremendous discipline, internal discipline. Now, which verse deals with balancing militancy and peacemaking?
The last one, a time for loving and a time for hating, a time for war and a time for peace.
Right. So this, as you said, do we see that people, is it a common thing for people who are militant and then peacemaking? No, it's rare. Usually you have like the military guy, he wants to solve everything, with a gun and a knife. You know what I'm saying? His solution to problems are militaristic. Conversely, the person who is from a diplomatic orientation wants to solve far from negotiations and solving problems. Even in families, you have people who want to solve problems by yelling and screaming and being aggressive, and the people that want to constantly try to negotiate everything, what they call in the family dynamic, the peacemaker. So a person who has the ability to be neither militant or neither naturally peacemaking, but be able to draw on each thing, as to go back what Shana said, what the situation demands. If the situation demands to be peacemaking, they can be peacemaking. If the situation needs to be militant, I'll be militant. You know what I'm saying? That's a very rare constant thing. That's why I felt that one of Menachem Begin's strengths, and he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, which he shared with Anwar Sadat. But it's a rare thing to be a guy who was a terrorist. He planted bombs. He blew up, they blew up the King David Hotel. I don't know if he was on that exact mission, his organization, Stern Gang, Irgun, et cetera. He's killing people. He's a disciple of Jabotinsky. Anyways, all right, let's get into the Parsha. The Parsha sort of like picks up sort of like the middle of the story. We have 9 sentences from the end of last week's Parsha Balak, and then we have we're going to pick up with 5 psukim from the beginning. This is talking about Pinchas. So let's just refresh everybody's recollection. Shana, read us out the last 10 psukim of last week's Parsha, which deal with the crisis in the episode. We'll start with this week's Parsha of Pinchas, about the reward. Go ahead.
From the end of Parshat Balak, Israel sins with Moab. Israel was staying in Shittim when the people began to behave immorally with the Moabite girls. The girls invited the people to their religious sacrifices, and the people ate and worshipped the Moabite gods. Israel thus became involved with Baal Peor, and God displayed anger against Israel. God said to Moses, "Take the people's leaders and have them impale the idolaters publicly before God. This will reverse Hashem's display of anger against Israel." Moses said to Israel's judges, "Each of you must kill your constituents who were involved with Baal Peor." The judges were still weeping in indecision at the communion tent entrance when an Israelite brought forth a Midianite woman to his brethren before the eyes of Moses and the Israelite community. When Pinchas, a son of Eleazar and a grandson of Aaron the priest, saw this, he rose up from the midst of the assemblage and took a spear in his hand. He followed the Israelite man into the tent's inner chamber and ran them through, driving the spear through the Israelite man and woman's groin. With that, the plague that had struck the Israelites was arrested. In that plague, 24,000 people had died.
Okay. So, yeah. So that's pretty... We discussed this event in senior fellowship last time, or last class. Okay. Now let's talk a look. Let's talk about Rashi on what Pinchas saw, and he responded to spear the couple. Go ahead.
Rashi and Pinchas saw. He saw what was being done, and he was thereby reminded of the law on this subject, from Sanhedrin 82a. He said to Moses, I have received a tradition from you. He who has intercourse with an Aramean, a heathen woman, zealous people may attack him. He replied to him, let him who reads the letter be the agent for executing it, straight away. Vayikach ramach biado, he took a javelin in his hand.
Okay, so based upon this read, Rashi's reading of the event, why was the plague, which struck down 24,000 people, stopped?
Because it seems like Pinchas acted on his understanding of the material and was given license by Moshe to go and act to actually carry out his intended activity.
Now, was he? What, now, did he act? Did he ask Moshe what to do?
No.
This was something. This law of what they call Kenayan Pogumbog, the zealous one may kill this a Jewish man who's having relations with a idolatrous woman. He remembered the halacha and he went ahead and executed the halacha. We're going to get into it in more detail what the halacha exactly is. Very interesting. We've had a class on this parsha maybe last year or 2 years ago. I don't remember when we did it on. Now let's talk about, just to get the full picture, now we go on to this week's parsha. All right, Shane, keep on going.
Beginning of Parshat Pinchas, Pinchas's reward. God, Hashem spoke to Moses, saying, Pinchas, a son of Eleazar and grandson of Aaron the priest, was the one who zealously took up my cause among the Israelites and turned my anger away from them so that I did not destroy them in my demand for exclusive worship. Therefore, tell him that I have given him my covenant of peace. This shall imply a covenant of eternal priesthood to him and his descendants after him. It is given to him because he zealously took up Hashem's cause and made atonement for the Israelites. The name of the man who was killed, along with the Midianite woman, was Zimri, son of Salu, a prince of the Simeonite patrician. The name of the Midianite woman who was killed was Cosbi, the daughter of Tzor, governor of a paternal line in Midian.
Okay, so I'm just going to quote the two questions from the Alatora website. The rest of the questions very nicely. Go ahead.
What is so uniquely praiseworthy about Pinchas's violent act, his zealous act, that it merited eternal covenants of peace and priesthood? And
the next question.
If Pinchas was simply following the laws of the Torah, why did he deserve such an exceptional reward? And if not, what gave him the right to take the law into his own hands, let alone be eternally recompensed for his bloodshed?
Okay. So you follow the question. In other words, he got the reward that he got, which we'll now get into what that reward was, of peace and priesthood. We'll get to Rashi in a moment. What was about this activity that he gets such a big reward? One. And if he's just following the halacha, then okay, so why does he get any exceptional reward? And if he's not doing the halacha, then why does he get to be a vigilante? All right, so I'm going to go to Rashi here, and we'll go back to the Rambam. All right, so I have Suzanne, Riyat Rashi. This is about the reward.
I give to him my covenant peace. This means I give him my covenant that it should be to him as a covenant of peace. Just like a man who shows gratitude and friendliness to one who has done him a kindness, so here too the Holy One, blessed be he, expressed to him his peaceful feelings towards him.
Go on.
And it should be unto him, this covenant of mine shall be unto him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood. For although the priesthood had already been given to Aaron's descendants, it was given only to Aaron and his sons who had been anointed together with him and to their offspring whom they might beget after they had anointed. But Pinchas, who had been born prior to that and had not been anointed, had not as yet attained the status of priesthood until now. So too do we read in Zevachim. Pinchas did not become a priest until he had slain Zimri.
Okay, so there's a whole debate about what the two things, the covenant of peace and the covenant of priesthood, eternal, everlasting priesthood. So Rashi says really they're one and the same thing, and that that basically since Pinchas, who's the son of Eliezer, was born before Eliezer, the son of Aaron, was anointed into the priesthood. So if Eliezer had a kid after Pinchas, Eleazar, that kid would become a Kohen. But since he's born before, he's not in the priesthood. So he becomes a member of the priesthood post facto. So the reward of him doing this act of slaying the couple of Zimri ben Salu, that's the prince of the tribe of Shimon, and who was having a relation with the princess from the tribe of Moab, Cosby, from Midian rather. So that he was not a Kohen before, now he's a Kohen, all right? So that's what the reward is. Now, obviously, the question is, well, like, why is that a good reward? Why is that an appropriate reward? All right, anybody want to lay in on that one? Why is that the guy did this activity, which we'll go into in some more halachic detail, why does he get this particular of all, seemingly random reward? What do you guys say? All right.
Well, it's a super inappropriate thing to be doing, to say the least, they were doing.
Right. So let's identify what's really their crime. The Jewish people are involved, not only first they get involved in sexual immorality. Then the women of Moab bring them into idolatry, okay? Then Hashem is very angry at the Jewish people for doing that. Moshe orders the judges to start delivering punishment for this. And a plague breaks out. And while this is all happening, this prince brings forth a midnight woman in front of Moshe and the entire community and goes in there. And then Pinchas follows suit and impales them. Okay?
It was almost like he had to stop this downward spiral of... It almost could have led to godlessness.
Right.
If he didn't stop this.
Okay, so it's interesting, but in general, don't we have Moshe before is mentioning to the judges, you gotta deal with like through the court system. And then Pinchas seems to be not waiting. He's acting seemingly impetuously. Okay? So we're going to learn two halachot about this law. All right, Mendel, read it out.
Rambam, Laws of Prohibited Sexual Relations, chapter 12, halacha 4. Whenever a man has relations with a Gentile woman in public, i.e. the relations are carried out in the presence of 10 or more Jews, if a zealous person strikes him and kills him, he's considered praiseworthy and ardent. This applies whether the relations were in the context of marriage or licentious in nature. This matter is a halacha conveyed to Moshe at Sinai. Support for this can be derived from Pinchas' slaying of Zimri. Halacha number 5. This zealous person can strike the fornicators only at the time of the relations, as was the case with regard to Zimri. As Numbers 25:8 states, he pierced the woman into her stomach. If, however, the transgressor withdraws, he should not be slain. Indeed, if the zealous person slays him, he may be executed as a murderer. If the zealous person comes to ask permission from the court to slay him, they do not instruct him to do so, even if this takes place at the time of the relations. Not only that, if the zealous person comes to kill the transgressor, and he withdraws and kills the zealous person in order to save himself, the transgressor is not executed for killing him. When a Jew has relations with the daughter of a resident alien, the zealous may not strike him. The transgressor should, however, be given stripes for rebellious conduct.
Okay. So let me ask you a simple question. Why is the person, the zealous one, what danger does he put upon himself by go ahead and doing this special halakha? Look carefully. This is a rather dangerous proposition.
I mean, he may get killed by the person who is committing the act. And he's got to make sure that...
Under what circumstance would the person doing the act not only kill the zealous one, but also not held liable for it?
It's self-defense.
Exactly. If they're not together, if the non-Jewish woman and the guy separate, and he goes out and kills the zealous person, he's exempt from any kind of he's exempt because he's his defense.
I mean, it appears that the only time the zealous person can actually, quote unquote, get away with doing this is if, in fact, he didn't ask anybody and he actually caught them literally mid-coitus.
Correct. And if he asked the Beis Din if he should do it or not, what do they tell him?
Don't do it.
So this is like, one second, how could you have the Beis Din tell him not to do the mitzvah?
Right.
But if he does do it, and he pierces them when they're together, what's the halacha? He's praiseworthy. So this halacha is completely baffling.
Right.
You have to make one move. Basically, this is a mitzvah, which obviously is not for everybody. First of all, if you do it, you're putting your life in your hands because you can end up getting killed doing this mitzvah. And if the couple are not together and they kill you, there's no recourse. That's number one. Number two, why is it? And you would think the guy before he commits kill somebody, another Jew, you would say that asking the court would be a good idea. But if he does do it, they say don't. They tell him not to do it. So one second, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? How would you solve this puzzle, this paradox?
By defining ardent and zealous.
Okay.
What does zealous mean and what does ardent mean? What is that?
Shubach and Azar is always the person who is like zealous. He's okay, well, that's my question to you. What do you guys say?
It seems like in the case of Pinchas, at least, which seems like the paradigm for this individual.
Yes.
That Pinchas is acting out of like he has zero question. He has He has total conviction in his action that what he's doing is stopping a grave injustice, and that he's demonstrating a total conviction in uprooting licentiousness from the nation publicly.
100%. In other words, you have to be on a certain level to do this mitzvah. If you're not certain and you ask the court, what do they tell you? You can't do it. Which means that it's not simply that this couple has to be killed. It has to be wise to be when they're together. It has to be evident what they're doing is publicly degrading the kedusha of the Jewish people by a Jewish man having relations with an idolatrous woman. A. It has to be done by a person who is self-evidently a great person. Tzaddik. Because the only person who's going to have absolute conviction to do this and willing to put himself in danger, in line of fire, is a person who's on a pretty lofty level. Okay? Because if there was like court protection that the guy couldn't get you, well, that would, you got nothing to lose. Here, you might go in there and you might not come out of there. So you have to be very convinced that you are doing the right thing and you're willing to risk your life essentially to do that right thing. And that you're doing it because you want to remove this public Chil Hashem, this public violation that basically these people are flaunting the entire sanctity of the Jewish people. And by doing it, doesn't mean they're having sex publicly. They're going into a tent, but it's self-evident what they're doing. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't mean they're actually having relations right out in the open field. I want to clarify that. All right. So now I think we can, with that approach, we can understand why he's rewarded by to be the Kohen. Before I show you the Gemara that sort of states the obvious, what do you guys say? Why is being a ward of being a Kohen a good thing or makes sense? All right, so I'm going to give you a hint. The Gemara actually says it. There's two little pieces of Gemara. All right, so let me have Shane read it out. This is from, again, Sanhedrin 82b that talks about, that explains, discusses the episode of Pinchas in more depth. Go ahead.
Pinchas came and slammed them on the ground before the omnipresent and said before him, Master of the universe, will 24,000 of the children of Israel fall due to these sinners? As it is stated, and those that died in the plague were 24,000. And that is the meaning of that which is written, and Pinchas stood and wrought judgment, and the plague was stayed. The Holy One, blessed be he, said to Moses, be the first to greet Pinchas with a blessing of peace, to honor him before the people. As it is stated, therefore say, I hereby give to him my covenant of peace. And it is stated, and it shall be unto him and to his descendants after a covenant of eternal priesthood, because he was zealous for his God, and he atoned for the children of Israel. And this atonement that he facilitated is worthy of continuing to atone forever.
So basically, his interest was to create atonement, that the Jews should be forgiven. And the Jews should be able to do what? He's an advocate for the well-being of the Jewish people. And he was basically arguing, now this is midrashically arguing with God, look, these are the egregious sinners over here. Why should all everybody suffer? Okay? So conversely, the following in the footsteps of Aaron is to gain atonement for the Jewish people, to better the Jewish people, to help them spiritually. That really is the hallmark of the mission and role of the Kohen. So it's appropriate that he becomes an honorary Kohen, even though that the Kahuna was sort of locked and sealed. But the main point for us, so Pinchas is the guy that had a clarity of what's right and wrong. He's on a very high level, willing to risk his life. He wasn't acting extra juridically outside the law, because really this is part of the law. There are circumstances when the law allows, in a very limited scope, that there can be cases where a person can be killed outside a whole lengthy, trial circumstance. Normal circumstances, a trial with witnesses, etc. and judged by 23 judges. There's a certain an emergency circumstance that a person's on that level, he can be the zealous one that can kill the couple. Now, which most people, I don't know about you, but most people would be ambivalent about killing somebody. You know, do I know the right thing? We wouldn't be able to do it. We'd be like, is it right? Not right. We'd be like paralyzed with what? With the absolute indecision. So we're obviously not the ones who can do it. And even if we get the guts to do it and we ask the court, they say, nope, you can't do it. Because why? It's not about simply killing the person, the couple, removing this evil, quote unquote, from the Jewish people. It has to be adjudicated by a person who is clearly an absolute righteous person, killed in a way that's self-evident what the crime is. In other words, they're skewered in the act of relations to remove the Chil Hashem. Now, the takeaway for us, obviously we're not Pinchas-esque, but there is a part of Pinchas which is something that we all need to absorb. A little bit of, we have in ours, let's call it developing our inner Pinchas. So Pinchas, interestingly enough, is a person who on one hand can act violently and ironically is given the what? The covenant of peace. So fundamentally, he's a peacemaker. He, in fact, if he wanted to go like Rambo crazy, he could have killed the other people that were involved in the women of Moab. He didn't use it as a situation just randomly mow down people. He wanted to reduce the problem by going to the actual epicenter of the problem of where a leader of the Jewish people takes the idolatrous princess, walks him in front of Moshe and all the Jewish people, and goes into a tent, clearly saying, I don't think we should have this unnecessary separation between Jew and non-Jew. In other words, fundamentally bringing out the age-old argument that really there's a brotherhood of man, and basically assimilation is fundamentally racism, and this is a good person, and why should we all not join together? Okay? That Zimri mentality is alive and well, has not ended. Okay? It's alive and well, and in fact, among the non-Orthodox, 71% will marry non-Jews. So Zimri's winning. Okay? That's the facts. But the quality that we can imbibe is really the quality of knowing when to be militant, knowing when to be an ambassador of peace. Let me give you a couple obvious situations. In your own family, every family has conflict. If there's no conflict, I don't think it's a family. So I've never seen that. So now, by and large, obviously, calm, you know, mediation and trying to reconcile typically overall going to be the best strategy. But sometimes you need to shake people up, wake them up to certain situations, and you have to be aggressive and loud and in their face. And do an intervention. Okay, there's a time for all that. So how to act, as Coelho says, a time for peace, a time for war, and simultaneously a time for silence and time for speaking. You know? So how to time for crying and time for dancing.
Is this a translation you got from like a Chabad site, or is this what's this translation from?
I got this translation from
is that Alatora?
From Safaria.org, and I think that they're taking it from the JPS 1985 translation. It's not bad. It gets the basic idea. But that really is a challenge. Most people you'll meet are often like, they have their predisposition, they can't get out of their way. In order, if they're very like quiet and don't like to be confrontational, well, that's going to be successful in many circumstances. But there's a time to be confrontational. Or conversely, let's say a person who's always being confrontational, always being aggressive, always being angry, always being in people's faces. Well, that's also not good. Okay? And they don't know how to be peaceful. So really, the emotional world, going back to our initial character, Menachem Begin's a very interesting person. This is a guy that's killed people in the defense of the Jewish people. Simultaneously, the person who can sit with an arch enemy, Anwar Sadat, and negotiate a peace deal. And simultaneously, when he needs to fight, renew fighting with the Palestinians and the Palestinian, you know, Fatah and the terrorist group, when they, and as they were holed up in Lebanon, he did that. So that's really a balanced thing. Oftentimes, people are militant when they're young and wuss out and become peacemakers when they get old because they don't have the energy, but. The Koheles person, let's call it the Koheles person, is always assessing, is it time to laugh? Is it time to cry? Is it time to fight? Is it time to be a peacemaker? You know what I'm saying? And that's, by the way, not so simple. It's a big demand upon us. And not to get stuck at believing any particular disposition is intrinsically a good one. Because reality is, they all are important in different situations, and you have to use your mind to figure out what character trait to deploy. You know what I'm saying? And many people cannot do this, but if you can do this, you will be successful. You know what I'm saying? And Pinchas was, on one hand, militant, courageous, and given and fundamentally a man of peace. It's a remarkable thing. We don't, in our society, we oftentimes herald certain people. We herald the Rambo-esque military hero, which we should, coming up July 4th tomorrow. But that person is a military person, a career military person, oftentimes fall into the trap trying to solve everything with the same tool. Everything is going to be solved militaristically. Or conversely, everything can be solved through diplomacy. It's not the case. You need to have both. This, by the way, is Judaism's rejection of the philosophy of pacifism. Anybody familiar with pacifism?
I mean, that was mostly put forth by the Quakers.
Well, they imbibed that. What is pacifism?
A rejection of all armed conflict.
Correct. That war isn't there is no such thing as a just war. Judaism maintains there is a just war. I mean, there's also an unjust war. Okay, but there's a time to fight. You know what I'm saying? And you can use this framework to understand the Israeli-Arab conflict within the Jewish people. There are people who are on the left that constantly are going to be more what? Want to do solve everything what? Diplomatically. We'll sit down. We'll work it out. It'll be great. But the only reason why it's not working out is because we're not sitting down and trying to work it out. And the people on the right is, you know what we should do? We should kick these people out. You know what I mean? We have, so either it's a war of extremes. And the reality is that this is a complicated, messy situation. That doesn't lend itself to a very simple either militaristic solution or a diplomatic solution. It's very, very complicated with a lot of factors. And how to navigate that is not a simple thing. I don't have the answer myself. I don't know. But I do know one thing. It is not simple. And either one that have used different modalities has not been successful. So we're stuck in a sort of a stasis. That's the situation. I mean, people get, for example, stuck in certain relationships where they can't, when people mistreat them, they can't act in their own best interest and being assertive and try to correct people who are treating them properly. Their modality is to be passive and not stand up for themselves. Or conversely, the other person is like the person, any small slight, the guy's in their guy's, he or she is in the other person's grill. You know what I'm saying? So we all dealt with both personalities. You know what I mean? The person that is always fighting about everything, that they're like, they got one strategy, that's how they navigate the situation, or the other people who just do not stand up for themselves and just get walked all over and they get taken advantage of, and when they should stand up for themselves, they don't. They endure, their solution is enduring the abuse. That's their way of solving life problems. The Torah here, with identifying Pinchas, many qualities, but one quality is, there's a time for peace, there's a time for war. There's a time for diplomacy, there's a time for fighting. There's a time for silence, there's a time for talking. And what to do, how to navigate that is really an art. That's really part of the art of life. And that's really what the parsha is teaching us. The art of life. All right, guys, have a great July 4th. Those who are at MJE, tomorrow we are off, and everybody will celebrate the independence. By the way, we should have a Karas HaTov. It's important to mention that we as Jews, America is the Medina of Chesed, is the country of kindness, who is the only country in 2,000 years for the most part, has been very good to us. So to, you know, fly the flag and celebrate and show gratitude to this great country because it's been very good to us. We're able, just imagine, we're able to learn. I'm not bothered. We could, you know, we don't have to, so many Jews who wanted to learn Torah like we're doing right now had to do this covertly. Just, in all of your lifetimes, if we wanted to have this class in Soviet Russia, that would be punishable by being taken to the gulag. Just remember that. So we have a sense of a tremendous gratitude, Hakar Tov, to this great nation who has opened the doors for us and allowing us to have freedom of religion and freedom of assembly, and such a great situation. So we have to, you know, when there's time to vote, do our civil duties to vote, time to celebrate the great nation. Tomorrow we should do that. You know, if you either have a vegan hot dog or a regular hot dog, depending on what your cuisine predilection is.
I mean, if you're eating vegan hot dogs, are you really a part of the nation? Is really
you are, in fact. This is a nation that embraces all types. So, carnivores, vegetarians, and vegans, quite welcome. That's it. And you enjoy fireworks. Well, Macy's fireworks. They're gonna have a big. For those who are in the New York area, they're really planning to knock it's the best ever event ever. And we should celebrate and appreciate and have gratitude for this great nation.
Thank you.
Well, I'll tell everyone.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Rabbi. I have a question about Pinchas, or two questions. First is, why are the English translations all over the place? And and second question is, if I remember correctly, reading the Parsha last week, there's a letter in the Hebrew for Pinchas that's kind of like, almost like it's a hidden letter.
Right. So Pinchas, so literally Pinchas, there's a yud there. So when you're doing, every time you have a name, it's a transliteration. So transliterations, there's no real rules. So you know, it'll be Phineas, it'll be Pinchas, it'll be Pinchas. So you're dealing with a transliteration, it's going to be all over the place. That's the nature of transliterations, A. And, the word Brith Shalom, the word, the covenant of peace, the word Shalom, the Vav is split. So it's cut in the middle. Are you referring to that one, or are you talking about actually the letter, the Pinchas, the Yud is small?
That one, but the Yud was small.
Yeah, so that's always an interesting thing. There are interesting things in the actual text of the font size. There are some unique fonts, like the Yud will be small, like in the Shema, it's a big Shin and a big Dalid. So, a big Ayin, a big Dalid. So, the answer is it's open for additional layer of interpretation. I don't remember off the bat what the idea is, but there's another idea there. So I charge you all, please research, why is there a small yud or a unusual yud in the font size of Pinchas's name? We'll look into it. If I find it, I'll shoot you an email. All right, guys. Lila Tov.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You got it.
Thanks.